Live from the Business Radio X studio inside Renaissance Bank, the bank that specializes in understanding you. It's time for North Fulton Business Radio.
And hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of North Fulton Business Radio. I'm John Ray, and we are coming to you from our virtual studio. No, we're not back in Renaissance Bank quite yet. Hopefully sometime soon, we'll let you know about that. But we still love the folks at Renaissance. They've done a great job with a lot of these SBA-related emergency loans that folks are applying for. I know that firsthand from some of the folks I hear from that have worked with Renaissance. So check them out. The branches are still closed to walk-ins, but you can go and make an appointment and go in and see them. So give them a call. Your local Renaissance office. If you don't know where to go, go to renaissancebank.com and check them out there. And they'll be glad to help you. And the drive-thrus are open, folks, so you can actually open an account at the drive-thru. Renaissance Bank, understanding you, member FDIC. And now I'm delighted to have Shane Jackson with us. Shane is with Jackson Healthcare. Shane, welcome.
Thanks, John. Great to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. So for those that don't know Jackson Healthcare, and there may be two or three that don't, tell them about your company and what you do.
We are in the business of making sure that doctors, nurses, healthcare providers are in the place they need to be to take care of patients. And so very simply, that's what we do. We do it through a number of ways. We have technology solutions that we provide to hospitals to make sure that caregivers are most efficient in how they're seeing patients. We're one of the largest telemedicine providers in the country. But the biggest part of what we do is in healthcare staffing. So we move doctors, nurses, therapists, pharmacists, kind of you name it, around the country. We work in all 50 states. And so they'd be working in a hospital, urgent care clinic, physician office, anywhere like that. But they're working for us, and we move them and have them work on temporary assignments in those locations.
Getting ready for this interview, you know, one of the things, let's give a shout out. Talking about, as we plan this interview, talking about your book on company culture, and it's a great book, by the way. So we'll come back around to that on another show.
But, I look forward to that.
Yeah, but there is so much going on in healthcare, and certainly in terms of staffing and where people are and deficits in staffing. That we felt like is important to cover this subject. Talk a little bit about the role you play in getting clinicians to hospitals and other healthcare facilities, how that's working right now in this environment.
Yeah, so from a big picture, what our industry does, the function we play in healthcare, is to make sure that providers are in the location where they're most needed. And so this plays out in a number of ways. And most people don't even realize that our industry exists. When I explain to most people what we do, they go, "You mean like a doctor works like as a temp, like with a temp agency?" And that's what they do. Really? Like, I didn't know that was a thing. So a few examples of the things that we do is moving nurses around the country to areas that have surges in demand. So like a very simple example, we move a lot of nurses to Florida during the winter because there's a bigger population in Florida in the winter than there is in the summer. And so they need more care. Every winter, we move healthcare providers to different areas of the country that are having surges in the flu, right? So we're used to that. And some of it is as simple as a doctor who wants to go on vacation, yet the patients don't stop getting sick just because he's at the beach.
Right.
Right. And so they need doctors to come in and take care of those patients while he's gone. And so there's all sorts of use cases. And so that's what we do. And there's a whole segment of the healthcare workforce, doctors, nurses, therapists, that this is how they work. No one knows exactly what the number is, but it's probably between about 150 and 175,000 people who this is how they work. It's a nurse that will go and work one place for 3 months, and then she'll fly across the country and work somewhere else for another 3 months or 6 months.
Wow.
And doctors who do, some more thing. This is how they practice. Some of them do it for just a season, maybe at the beginning of their career where they're trying to figure out where they want to live. A lot of them at the end of their career, maybe while they don't want to retire, but they're kind of tired of working full time. They want to work 6 months out of the year. They do this. And then there's a growing portion of doctors, especially, that this is their career. This is how they practice, and they specialize in the ability to come in somewhere and very quickly acclimate to care of patients. So that's what we do. So when the COVID crisis hit, we were in a really unique position to help, in a really unique position to understand what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing that hit us was, as everyone started hearing about, at first some facilities voluntarily, and then at the direction of the federal or state governments, canceling elective surgeries. And a lot of people didn't realize really what that meant. Well, it meant that everyone whose job revolves around the OR, so surgeons and anesthesiologists and nurse anesthetists and OR nurses and surgical techs and all these people that work around the OR, what it meant was they were all out of a job basically overnight. And so that's a big part of our business is working with those types of medical providers. And so we started seeing over the first 2 to 3 weeks of March, really most of March, just a lot of those doctors and nurses being sent home. They're out of work. They couldn't do anything. And we know why this was done. It was done to be able to save PPE, to be able to free up beds for potential surges of patients and that sort of thing. But it created a huge disruption in the healthcare workforce. The next thing that happened then was we saw the hotspots coming up in places like New York, in places like New Orleans and Michigan. Seattle was the first one. Here locally in the state of Georgia, Albany.
Right.
Was the big one that we've had.
Sure.
And so there was this incredible demand for anyone who could work with critical patients. And so these are critical care doctors, intensivists, critical care nurses, respiratory therapists. You probably remember hearing a lot about how many of these COVID patients had to be on ventilators. Respiratory therapists work with patients who had been on ventilators. And it was just an incredible demand to be able to send people to those specialties to places like New York. And got to the point where, there's only so many critical care doctors in the country. And so we were having to move them all over, and can talk more about that. Now what we're seeing is a decline in the COVID-related work because the hotspots have cooled off, for lack of a better term. And but yet the rest of healthcare hasn't gone back to work yet. And so it's just ironic that we have, in the midst of a global pandemic, the highest healthcare unemployment in our history. Thousands, probably millions of doctors and nurses have been furloughed, laid off, that sort of thing, and are just waiting for healthcare to restart.
You know, there's probably not one out of 50 people you could pull off the sidewalk in North Fulton that would believe that healthcare unemployment is as high as you represent. I mean, because that's not the perception.
No, it's not. And I can't tell you, even the ones that are people are still working, how many have been asked to take pay cuts, and that sort of thing. And it's pretty incredible. What people have seen on TV for the last 2 months are images that have been out of hospitals in New York, or images out of places like Phoebe Putney and Albany, where they just got overwhelmed, and they have images of patients in beds lining the hallways because they didn't have anywhere to put them. And we have seen so many interviews with these amazing doctors and nurses who voluntarily went into these places to treat these incredibly sick patients who had this disease that we didn't understand, that we were all afraid of, that especially at first, back in March, beginning of April, we didn't really know how to treat yet. And we had just so many stories I can tell you of the thousands of these providers that work for us who volunteered, left their family, traveled across the country to go in and take care of some of these patients, many of whom ended up getting sick themselves. And it's incredible. And those people should be celebrated. You mentioned before we got on the air about the hashtag healthcare heroes.
Right.
They are heroes. Like, I don't want to take anything away from that.
Sure.
However, what you haven't seen on TV is that most hospitals and the vast majority of healthcare facilities, including non-hospitals, have had a fraction of the patients that they normally have.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not just surgeries that have been canceled. People are nervous about going to see their doctor or to go into any kind of healthcare facility for any reason. And so there's just incredible decline in patient volumes. And it's a real challenge for the people that work in that industry. Healthcare typically has the lowest unemployment of any industry in our country. And right now, a lot of those folks are out of work.
Folks, if you just joined us, we're speaking with Shane Jackson. He's president of Jackson Healthcare. And Shane, it's not just hospitals. As we were discussing before we came on, it's more than hospitals. It's the family practice. It's the urgent care center around the corner. It's places in the neighborhood, shall we say, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's when we talk about healthcare, for most people, they think of hospitals.
Right.
You know, like healthcare, hospitals. And, you know, I think some of that probably we have TV to blame, ER and Grey's Anatomy and, all these shows that we've watched, they're all centered around the hospital. Well, mm-hmm. It turns out that actually, a lot more patients are seen outside of a hospital setting than they are inside of a setting. And it's just like you just said, like even your physician practice. I mean, I talked to a pediatrician, this is probably 2 or 3 weeks ago now. And she said she has about 25% of the patient volume that she normally has.
Mm.
And so if you think about that, what that means is you've got a lot of people who are not getting their preventative care. You've got kids who aren't getting their vaccination shots, who aren't getting their checkups. We're hearing from oncologists and oncology practices that cancer patients aren't getting their treatment. This is happening all over, from psychiatrists and behavioral health centers, that psychiatric patients aren't getting their drugs and their psychotropic injections and those sorts of things.
Mm.
All of these things are not just causing a problem today. They're all going to cause more severe long-term health problems for our population.
Mm-hmm.
If your kid doesn't get vaccinated and then gets the measles, that causes a lot of problems, right? And so this has got longer term ramifications to it than I think people are realizing. It's not just about hospitals. It's certainly not just about hospitals in the hot spots. This is an entire healthcare system that is really kind of suffering being abandoned right now.
Yeah, I think people see the pictures on television and think ventilators and COVID-19 treatment, and don't understand how the impact of COVID-19, what that's done to hospitals and healthcare providers generally, but the financial impact is significant, and maybe you can address a little bit of that. I mean, you touched on that with that example about the pediatrician that's at a quarter of their previous capacity. As you said, there's no business that can make money that way, none. So what are you seeing generally, though, with hospitals and other healthcare providers, and what's going to come out of all this?
Yeah. So the first of all, and there has been a lot of talk about this, but surgery is the main profit driver for hospitals. It's the most profitable thing that they do. And then, you know, you add into that the ambulatory surgical centers and all those sorts of things. It's an incredibly important part. And the patients that are coming in for COVID, there is reimbursement around it, but these are really sick patients that take up a lot of resources, and the reimbursement is not that great. Mm-hmm. You know, even the hospitals that have had a lot of COVID patients, they're not making money off these patients.
Right.
And so that's why you're seeing an eagerness, a cautious eagerness, but the hospitals and surgeons, everyone involved, is really trying to work through how they can very safely resume surgery. It sounds bad to think about it this way, but financially we need to do that in order to start getting some of these healthcare facilities back on solid ground. There's also obviously a big patient care argument that we have a lot of people who are waiting on surgeries. You know,
right?
When people hear the term elective surgery, I think people that aren't in our healthcare industry, you know, I think it conjures images in their mind of like cosmetic surgery or something. You know, sure. We're not talking about tummy tucks and you know, eyebrow lifts and that sort of thing here. We're talking about people who are dealing with chronic pain, people who have real life limiting issues that are going on that need these surgeries, and that at some point, if they keep being delayed, become more severe issues that we have to deal with. And so economically important from a patient care standpoint, it's important. Certainly in a lot of the legislation that's been passed, there's been a lot of money that's been distributed out to these health systems and healthcare facilities that has enabled them to keep their doors open. Mm-hmm. You know, it's unfortunate we had to do that. It was necessary, but it's something that can only happen for so long. And we've got to get these guys back on their feet financially.
What kind of advice are you giving hospitals and other healthcare facilities around their staffing issues at this point, since we're in this netherland, that we seem to be in right now? What kind of advice are you giving?
Yes. The facilities that we're talking to, and really across the country, you know, right now they're just trying to get back up and going, and they want to get their staff that they have still there busy, then hopefully bring back people that they furloughed or laid off, get everyone back to full compensation and all that sort of thing. And we're just very early in that curve. However, what we're talking to them about is that in the midst of doing that, they also have to be ready for a potential surge. Mm. And so this is actually a pretty complicated thing to think through if you're a hospital, because a lot of the additional bed capacity that they've created to be able to handle, additional COVID patients came from other areas of the hospital. And so as an example, one of the things that a lot of hospitals did is they took beds from patients who have come out of surgery, post-op beds, mm-hmm. Other areas. Well, if you start redoing surgery, then you've got people in those beds. If you have a surge in COVID patients, you can't use those as critical care beds.
Right.
And so one of the things they're working on right now is how do they maintain some surge capacity? The state of Georgia, I think, is helping with this, with these modular hospitals that they're building around the state. I think that's an important tool in our ability here in Georgia to be able to handle that. So they think about it from a facility standpoint. What we're trying to help them think about is it from a staffing standpoint, because turning on the beds, getting those available, is actually the simpler part of the equation. The more difficult part is, how do I get a whole bunch of critical care nurses and intensive care doctors and that sort of thing on site in order to staff these beds and take care of those patients? And so we have some solutions and things that we do that we can help them through that. But the most important thing for them is to think through that strategy so that they're prepared, because this has got to be a both and. We have to be able to take care of patients in non-COVID related situations. We got to be able to do surgeries. We got to be able to do all these things. And we also have to be prepared for another surge in COVID. And that's what we've got to do. And so from a facility standpoint, we have to do that. But from a staffing standpoint, we have to have the mechanisms in place to do that.
You know, I'm curious, we've talked a lot about the industry you serve, and I want to get to how you serve it, because I guess, for lack of a better way to put it, you're really good at the logistics of people, right? I mean, moving people around the country. And I'm wondering the kind of stress that put on your business and how you have been working through that. What has that been like for you?
Yeah, you know, I really appreciate you asking that. I will tell you that the last 2 months, and I would really say the first 6 weeks of this thing, from mid-March through the end of April, were as busy and a stressful time as I think I've personally experienced in my career. And I think I can say that probably on behalf of the associates that work as a part of our companies. We had truly had hundreds of people, our internal associates now, I'm talking about, not necessarily even our doctors and nurses, but our internal associates that handle all logistics of that, who were working 14 hours a day, 7 days a week for 6 weeks. And I remember back in mid-April, I put a dictate out to some of our people that they had to take Easter off, because at that point they've been working 7 days a week for four straight weeks. And I said, guys, you need a day off, and don't check your email, you know?
Right.
And it was exhausting. I think it was really from a standpoint though, in being able to just talk to these folks that, you know, this is during a time where I think a lot of us just felt helpless. I remember hearing that even from some of our friends are like, I know that they're telling me my duty is to stay home and that's how I can help. But wow, that just doesn't feel like I'm helping. I'm helpless to do anything. And I think our company was in such a unique situation to actually be able to help. I mean, we sent hundreds of doctors and nurses to New York. We've deployed more than 1,000 COVID workers in the state of Georgia. I think it's like 1,100 now. These are people who came in to take care of incredibly sick patients who were able to give respite and a break to these healthcare workers who were already there and had been working around the clock trying to take care of these patients. When one of our nurses shows up, it means they get to actually take a day off and just rest and recover. And I just think our team saw that as an opportunity to do what we do best and really make a difference. And it's a unique time. What we do is important, but man, it's felt so, so important over the last few weeks. And so we've had some people that have been working hard and think are tired, and, you know, maybe here over the next few weeks, things open up, send everybody can go hang out on the beach for a minute or something and recover a little bit. But it's been a lot of pride associated with it, but a lot of stress too.
Folks, we're chatting here with Shane Jackson. He's the president of Jackson Healthcare. You've got to have a lot of pride in your people. I mean, that comes through with what you just said.
Oh, there's no doubt. We have, you know, the books on culture, you mentioned that at the beginning, so we weren't going to talk about that, but I do think it's related. We have just a really amazing culture within our company, and it's based primarily on a value of serving other people. That's the common value, the primary common value that really, I think, binds the associates of Jackson Healthcare. It impacts everything that we do. And when you have a big group of people who have this core commitment to helping others, man, it just creates an awesome atmosphere. And it comes out in the way we treat each other. It comes out in the way that we think about our clients. It comes out in the way that we try to serve our amazing doctors and nurses that work with us. And I just think it's an incredible place. I'm biased, obviously, but I think it's a pretty incredible group of people. And I'm so honored to get to work with these guys every day.
That's awesome. Now, we've talked about your heroes, if you will, that are your colleagues and associates. Well, let's talk about you. You hear stories all the time, given where you sit, of heroism and positive stories from folks that are working on the front lines of this crisis. Maybe you can share a few of those.
Yeah, I'm happy to. It's almost hard to know where to start. As you said, we've deployed thousands of people now into COVID work areas where they're going to be working with COVID patients. And first of all, just some of the emails I've gotten and comments I've seen from people who were saying things like, look, I know this is scary, but this is why I became a nurse, or this is why I became a doctor. And I feel like this is the moment I was called for. And you know, one who sent an email just saying, you send me the place you need me most. Pay me whatever you can pay me. I'm going there to take care of people. And it's just awe-inspiring. I'll tell you the story. This is probably my favorite one. And it's one of the things that happened right towards the beginning of this. So if you remember, the first place in the United States where really this broke out and we had kind of a hot spot was in Seattle, just south of Seattle, actually.
Right.
And that was in early March. And that was before it was really still on anyone's radar that this was going to be a national problem, and probably was the thing. Seattle was probably the place that made people realize that this was going to be an issue in the US. We had a doctor that we sent out to Seattle to work with COVID patients. And I think, if I remember correctly, he arrived there on March 2nd. Now, again, this is before we knew anything about this disease, this virus. And it was a really kind of scary situation to go into as a doctor. So he went in, worked with patients, sure enough, got exposed, had to self-quarantine in a hotel. At this time, tests were just, you know, not available like at all. Somehow he was able to find a test for himself, got tested, and was positive. So couldn't travel. He was stuck in Seattle. He's from the East Coast. Stuck in his hotel for 3 weeks. He was sick, but his symptoms were relatively mild. And so he called us and he said, you know, I can still see patients. And so we connected him via telemedicine with that facility so he could keep seeing patients while he was 3,000 miles from home, quarantined in a hotel room by himself, and kept seeing patients via telemedicine. And I thought, man, doesn't that just tell you about the devotion that so many of our doctors have towards taking care of people?
Yeah.
Just a lot like that, but it's been inspiring.
Wow. This has been great. And on the way out here, let's at least sideswipe culture. So you're because that's actually important right now. And folks, again, the book is Fostering Culture. Shane's book on culture in the workplace. There's a whole culture issue around folks that are suddenly working remotely, waiting for offices to reopen. What advice would you give business leaders out there that are dealing with a sudden change in company culture?
What drives a culture is the common values of that group of people. And because values and beliefs, those things we believe to be true, the things that are really important to us, they drive culture because they inform our actions, right? Everything I see, the decisions that I make, the things I decide to do, the things I decide not to do, is because of what I value, what's important to me, and the things I believe, what works, what doesn't work. Well, regardless of the situation you're in, that's going to be true. And so it means regardless of whether you are communicating with a coworker in person or via a teleconference, that's going to continue to be true. And so, for us, we have tried to, and for me personally, tried to think about over the last couple of months while we've all been remote, what are those beliefs that we have about how we treat each other? How do we apply those in a remote situation where we're not physically together? And so, it changes the way that it's manifested, but I don't know that our culture has changed, because the way that we talk to each other, the way that we communicate, the way that we honor each other or disparage each other or critique each other or encourage each other, all those sorts of things remain the same because they come from the same values no matter where we are. The thing I would say that we have to be careful about is that all of us, people behave differently in times of stress than we do in times of normal times. Mm-hmm. And so those parts of our personality, the way we deal with change, the way we communicate, how we handle all that, they can change. They can become more extreme when we're in periods of stress. Mm. And so I think it's we've got to have that ability to communicate honestly with each other, to be able to recognize that stress, give grace to each other around it, and communicate each other around it. I mean, I can tell you, as I said, this, especially kind of through March and April, is as stressed as I've been, in a long time. And thankfully, it's part of our cultural norm to care for each other and be able to communicate honestly with each other. Because I've even had some of my colleagues who are like, hey, you're stressed. Let's think about how we're communicating and that sort of thing. And so anyway, I don't know if that's helpful, but I think it's going to, your culture is going to transcend location. It's just going to manifest differently than normal.
Shane Jackson with Jackson Healthcare. Shane, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for being with us and providing your perspective on a number of important issues that we're dealing with as a society and right now. For those that would like more information on Jackson Healthcare, why don't you tell them where they can go?
Absolutely. It's easy. Just go to jacksonhealthcare.com and you can find out lots of information about us, and hope to get to see a lot of people in person somewhere, just anywhere in person soon.
That's right. With something other than a virtual background, right? So a real background. Shane, this has been awesome. Thanks again for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Folks, just a quick reminder that you can find this show on all the major podcast apps. That would be Apple, Google, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify. We're on all of them, so check them out. Subscribe to us. North Fulton Business Radio is where you can find is the search term, and that's how you can find us. Or go to northfultonbusinessradio.com. We've got an archive of 230 some shows with business leaders like Shane that have been with us over these past 4 years. So check that out as well. So for my guest, Shane Jackson, I'm John Ray. Join us next time here on North Fulton Business Radio.